We're going to be teaching learning two texts from Dirshuni, a collection called Dirshuni. These are really for the past several years, maybe 5 years, I've done so much teaching from Dirshuni, and I find it to be some of the richest and most resonant learning and teaching I've done. I feel like when I teach Dirshuni, I feel like this is a gift. It's been a gift in my life, and I'm so excited to like get to share this gift with you, which is true of all of Torah, but for me is especially true of Dirshuni, and since this is a gift you might not have encountered yet, I'm really just so excited to share it. Dirshuni is a collection of modern Israeli women's midrash, and both volumes were edited. There's two Hebrew volumes, and now there's one English volume in translation. Both of the Hebrew volumes have the same editor as a scholar named Tamar Biala, who started writing Midrash. She describes how she started to write Midrash as a way to stay inside the tradition. Or I've heard her also describe it as like a way of screaming onto the page. When she encountered things that she felt she just couldn't stand by, she felt like she had two options. She could like run screaming in the other direction, or she could write Midrash. And she's an incredible scholar, like the kinds of Midrashim that she writes. We are going to read one of her Midrashim today, are really so beautiful and inspiring. And another thing I like to say in introducing Tamar is that the first time I ever learned from her, encountered Dirshuni, was I was in rabbinical school in Israel in my Israel year, and she taught a session at like a Hartman gathering of rabbinical students, and she cried while she was teaching. And it made an incredible impact on me as a student in rabbinical school that I thought like, wow, this is a way of teaching I didn't know was possible. I didn't know you could teach in a way that was so emotionally present that you could actually cry during your class that you were teaching. I've heard her teach several times since then, maybe 10. I would say she's cried most of those times that I've heard her teach. Like, this is how she moves through the world. Also, her midrashim, you'll see tears in her midrash. Almost all of her midrashim, tears show up in her midrashim. And they almost all have, like, an reclaiming or a different way of understanding tears than we're used to, of, like, tears as weakness or tears as weepy. Like, those are not her tears. She has very strong, powerful, empowering emotional tears. So I like to share that just to sort of like bring her into the room, although I feel like when you read Midrashim that she writes, you, even without meeting her, will say like, oh yeah, I could see that she would be a teacher who cries while she's teaching. So she started writing Midrash for herself. She just knew of one or two other women in Israel who were writing Midrash. So she had this little tiny collection of Midrashim. She encountered another woman who said like, oh, I've also been writing Midrash, and I also have two or three Midrashim from a few friends. Like, we could put our two or three Midrashim together. And they did, apparently, when they first started this, like what you would do on the internet, they took out like an ad in it. Newspaper in Israel when they first started the project that said, like, we're looking to write a volume of Israeli women's midrash. Does anybody want to write submissions? And they got over 200 submissions.
Wow.
So they were sort of blown away to say, oh, this is not just like something we're doing, but this is a phenomenon. This is something that's happening. And the first book of Dirshuni was published and made it out into the world. And then there were so many women who were inspired by the first one who wrote Midrashim of their own that they then created a second volume. But an exciting thing about the second volume is that Rabbi Avital Hochstein, who's been teaching here this morning, has a Dirshuni Midrash published in this one. And it's been really interesting. She taught a session once, actually, on how when the first one came out, she was very resistant to the idea that went modern Midrash. She didn't like the idea, and actually she came so far around on the idea that she's actually published in the second in the second volume. I'll say one more word about it, which is that some of the Midrashim in Dirshuni really look like classical Midrash, right? I could put them on a page with like a surprisingly feminist classical Midrash, which exists, right? And put them next to each other and say, which one's the real Midrash, you know, which one is the ancient Midrash and which one is the modern Midrash? And you would not be able to tell the difference. And some of the Midrashim have a different feel. And Tamar's in particular usually are not the ones that feel like ancient Midrash. Hers feel like, I have this way of describing them as they're like part poetry, part midrash, part social commentary, part short story. I would say of all of her midrashim, the one we're going to look at here, I think, sort of leans most into short story. I feel like it feels to me least like Midrash and most of her Midrashim like short story, but they sort of all have Midrashic elements. The Midrashim in Deir Shuni are drawing from all the, you know, the same way that you read Midrash and you sort of imagine that the rabbis know all of Tanakh and are drawing on all of Tanakh. The Midrashim in Deir Shuni are drawing on like all of Tanakh and all of Midrash and all of, you know, the Gemara and modern things that are happening in the state of Israel. So many of her Midrashim are also sort of a commentary on something else. The topic at hand, the title here says A God Who Knows Women. And I'll say I taught a multi-part series on Deir Shuni in a seminar that Hadar did on God. And I came to this phrase of like, this is what I think is so powerful about these texts, is that they present me with a God who knows the experiences of women and interacts with women. And to me, that's extremely powerful. This particular session, I think probably actually would be better titled, like, How Do Women Know God? So there's sort of, sort of could be a version of the question, like, were the women at Sinai, right? There's this classic sort of question, were women at Sinai? And under that question of were women at Sinai is, where do women get revelation, right? And there's two, this is going to be, like, super oversimplified. Maybe there's two possible answers, right? One possible answer is women get revelation the same way that men get revelation, which is at Sinai, or, you know, through the Ten Commandments, through revelation. And then maybe there's an alternate answer, which is like, no, women actually get revelation in different ways. And one of those answers might appeal to you more on instinct, and one of them might appeal to you less, and or you find one of them offensive. Different people find different of them offensive, right? sometimes women have a resistance of like, don't tell me we're just like men. Women are different. We need to be different. We need space to be different. We need space for gender to be real. We don't want to just be told like, you know, the way that you solve egalitarianism is that you just copy paste everything that's true for men onto women. That doesn't work. And some people resist the other, right? Sometimes people grew up in an Orthodox upbringing where they were told, like, you're more spiritual than men. That's why you're not allowed to wear tefillin. And that can feel genuine to people, and that can feel really painful to be told, like, no, maybe I want to receive revelation the way that men got it. I don't want to be told there's some other way. So I would say those are sort of some of the questions that are in the background of these two Midrashim we're going to study. Who will read for us in the English? And I'll stop you probably almost every paragraph just to...
The Giving of the Ten Commandments. This is a story of a young woman who was sitting in synagogue while the Ten Commandments were being read.
Wait, I'm just going to stop. Just the very first word just to say this is like Ma'aseh Ba'alma. This is a Maisa. It's like here's a story, right? And sometimes this is a rabbinic way of introducing a story, is they say, ma'aseh be, you know, whatever, I'm about to tell you a story. So even though it feels very short story, it is written in this language, this rabbinic language. It's like, this is a ma'aseh, a ma'aseh.
The reader was chanting so expertly that the young woman felt it was as though she was hearing them for the first time. And she was astonished at what she heard, and her heart became aggrieved.
All right, so I'll pause there. I find this paragraph extremely relatable. I don't know if you've had this experience, right? Where you're like, I've read the Torah or the Siddur or this text 1,000 times. And then you read it sometime, someday. She has this language of like, the reader is chanting so expertly that she somehow has this experience, like she's hearing the Torah for the first time. And like, she can feel like, it, you know, it hurts a little. There's something in it that tugs, that hurts, that she says, like, oh, this is not... The word here for aggrieved is mitaker, is like, maim akrim, is like murky waters, is like what way you... You know, it's like, there's something off about this. And this... So we start with this character who has this experience that I just feel like already when you say, what does this midrash offer? Just saying to women, like when you are reading through a text and you hit into something that has never felt offensive and suddenly it hurts, like that can happen, right? That's an experience. I don't know about you. For me, it's like, okay, I'm her. I'm with you. I've had this moment.
Okay. She asked in her heart, what is the nature of remember the Sabbath to hallow it? of which it is said, you shall do no work, you and your son and your daughter, your male slave and your slave girl, and your beast and your sojourner who is within your gates. And his wife, what about her? Is she not commanded to hallow the Sabbath?
Okay, so if we pause for a second, what is she noticing? What did she notice that upset her?
She's not there.
Yeah, the wife is not mentioned.
In what ways is she not there?
She's not part of the list. She was not commanded to.
Yeah, right. There's two ways she could be in this list, right? This commandment is in second person male singular. So she could be commanded. She says, I'm not there. I don't feel like I'm part of the commanded. And I'm also not in the list of the people who get to rest. She's not in either place. So she's listening to the commands, and she says, wait, are these for me? Yeah.
I've heard this interpreted recently as, well, of course she's not in the list. And maybe this is just the justification after the fact. Because everything listed after the atah are those dependent. And the interpretation is, of course she's not listed because she's independent.
Yeah, so then she might want to be represented. She might want to feel like it's talking to her also then. Yeah, I also think it's striking, right, that it's not totally obvious to her that she's not. Like, she's read the Ten Commandments probably many times in her life, right? Every year, at least. A couple times. This has never struck her before until now when she's really listening. And she's like, you know, when I really listen, I actually don't hear myself in this text. I don't hear myself in this story. And also classical Midrashim pick up on this problem.
And what is the nature of you shall not covet, of which it is said, you shall not covet your fellow man's wife, or his male slave, or his slave girl, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that your fellow man has. And his wife, what about her? Did the Torah not command her, too, not to covet that which is her fellow woman's?
All right, so she's picked out two different problems, right? She's not in two of the commandments.
The young woman was pious, and not until that day had she had a single foreign musing or doubt regarding the truth of Torah. At that moment of questioning, her heart was wrapped in fear, beating and beating, until she thought everyone in the synagogue could hear its rhythm. The tears that rose in her throat had the taste of the deep and the taste of the sea that drowned the Egyptians, and she was shaking and aghast, and her soul fled.
All right. It's intense. She's an intense storyteller. Okay, here's what happened. First is she was pious, right? And the word in Hebrew that we have here is tzedeket, right? She's like a tzaddik. She's pious. And I think this is a really intentional choice here. First of all, this is Tamar saying, if you've had these thoughts, you are pious, right? It's not she. This is a thought that pious people have also, right? It's not impious to ask these questions. She's a pious person. Some people ask questions because they're nudniks, right? Or because they want to push back, or because the way they move through the world is rejecting Torah. That's not this woman, right? She's not here to reject Torah. She's a pious person. I think also there's an echo in Sedeket of the story of Tamar. Yehuda says, tzadka mimeni, like she is more righteous than I, but also like tzodeket, like she's correct, right? This is also Tamar saying like, and by the way, she's right. She's noticing this problem, and by the way, she's right. This is a problem, and I'm not going to beat around the bush about that. I'm going to just label her really clearly as both pious and correct. She's tzodeket here, and she's a tzodeket. That's sort of this opening, right? And then this language, just to draw it out, the fear here is pachad, not yirah, if you're listening for that difference. And that she is mitatef b'pachad, right? It's like she should be mitatef b'tzitzit,
right?
Here in Da'an Shul, maybe. And she is mitatef b'pachad. Her heart is wrapped in fear, beating and beating until she thought everyone in synagogue could hear its rhythm. This to me also, you know, Beit Knesset is the synagogue translation here. I just find this very relatable. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. You're sitting in a class or you're sitting in a panel and you're so agitated at something you heard that like your heart is racing that you feel like, why is everybody else not noticed? Like, first of all, can everybody else see how upset I am? Like, can you see it just from looking at me? And also like, why is everyone else just sitting around thinking that this is a normal Shul, like, don't they see that some major problem is happening here? It's like, she's having this problem that is deep, and she's wondering, like, is anyone else in touch with my heartbeat? Can other people see?
Well, I would think that she would say, why don't they know that my heart is beating so? Because maybe they're also feeling the same way, sitting on the same side of the mechitza.
Mm-hmm. Meaning this feels to you like she's sitting in a shul where she doesn't get to lean.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I taught this at a Shavuot retreat once with there were these teens. Shavuot retreats are an amazing place to teach intergenerationally, right? I had teenagers and the next midrash we're going to look at is about childbirth. I was like, oh, interesting to teach about childbirth with children. it was interesting. This teenage girl was talking about the experience of laning these. She was like, oh, I lane this part. This is one of the things I like to lane. Like, I'm going to think about this midrash when I lane it. It's like, yeah.
Well, to that question, in the first sentence, it says that she had not, it seemed like until that day, she had not had a single form using her doubt regarding the truth of Torah, which maybe tells us something about, to your point about, what language she's been given to help her navigate and relate to and connect with the text.
Yeah.
Also, it's beautiful that the taste is like of the Tehom.
Mm-hmm.
And the Yam, the two, that sort of goes right back to that Ur.
Yeah.
The beginning.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, right. So this is a great example of the ways in which tears, which could be shallow, oh, she's so weepy, she just got upset and she started crying, is instead from not only a deep place, but the deepest place, right? It's from the Tahom. And also, what she's responding to is this question about revelation, right, is the Ten Commandments. And the tears are from creation, Tahom, and redemption, that the sea that drowned in Egypt, right? Like, her tears are actually connecting her to these sort of other touchstones of what Judaism is, at its heart. Yeah.
I stopped with the tears came from her throat because I think, tears don't come from the throat. I mean, crying involves the throat, but tears don't come from the throat. But the Tehom is chaos, right? She's her whole belief structure is maybe coming
uprooted.
Undone.
Uh-huh.
And with the Mabul, right? You would have thought the rain only comes from below, from above, but the rain also comes from below. So there's this sort of the tears from above and the tears from below.
Right. And the sea that drowns the Egyptians also comes from the sides. Right. That's really interesting, right? The waters are, and it is, right, it's such a resonant, deep way to say she's drowning. She's having this moment of drowning, right? And that's what her tears are, which is nothing sort of superficial about them. And then parchadata, right? So what does that mean? Some kind of severing, right? Her soul fled is the translation here, she passed out. I don't know. To me, I feel like this is where we enter midrash, or this is where we enter magical realism, because the midrash is going to take a real shift, right? It's I'm her, except for now I'm not her anymore, because what's going to happen next? Yeah.
No, I was just going to ask a question about that, because I feel like normally when you read that phraseology, that's she died.
Yeah, right.
Right? So is she just dead?
Right.
Did she just die and chill?
Right. Did this realization actually kill her?
Yeah. Right.
It doesn't seem to me from the Midrash that it's that's what it means, but certainly I think you're meant to ask that question.
How does this link to the words at Ma'amad Har Sinai when B'nai Israel also has this moment of their souls?
Yeah, Parchadata. I think it's an intentional resonance, right, of she is experiencing revelation now somehow, and she's about to actually experience revelation. She's about to interact with God directly. So it's in some ways she's having a spiritual crisis and she's drowning, and in some ways actually she's having a moment of clarity that's actually about to open her up to a real religious experience. It's sometimes our real religious moments of connection are from the positive ecstasy, and sometimes they're from the, the depths in the hardest moments, and she's about to have it in the worst. Yeah.
The Holy Blessed One gathered up her soul in the palm of his hand and was looking and smiling at her. He said to her, "How long have I waited for you to come and ask me, so that I might reveal to you that which has been hidden away with me for 3,000 years?" She cast her eyes downward and asked, "Did the Holy Blessed One not speak with women at Mount Sinai, and not command them the same things he commanded men with thunder and lightning?"
All right, so here's, just to take a minute, right? Asaf, God gathers her up. Asaf HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the kapo in God's hand. It makes me think of two images. One is like Tachanun, right? Where we say like, Nipalana biyad Adonai, is like, God, you know, let me fall into God's hand. Because the soul flying, it could be like, and then she ran out of the room and she never went back to shul ever again. And like, this is the story of how she gave up on religion, right? Meaning this is obviously like, has echoes of Tamar's personal story, which I was sharing before. And instead she falls into God's hand, which I feel like that's what we are davening for in Tachanun, right? We're saying like, when I'm going to fall, I want to fall towards God. So she gets to, in this story, fall, but fall towards God, where God gathers her in here. And the other, like this word kapo has an echo, I think, of when Noah sends the birds out from the ark. The birds don't just come back, like Noah puts out his hand and like gathers them back in, brings the bird back in. So there's this way in which God is like, you can imagine God like reaching out to say like, oh, don't fly away, like come back and like let's talk about it, and sort of like brings her in. Okay, one thing I wanted to point out is the chiyuch, right, is God smiling, I think is another way of her highlighting like she wants to make clear to us that God, that this woman is right, not wrong, right? God is not angry. God is not concerned. God is smiling here, pulling her in.
Isn't that the same word in the most important rabbinic text that we ever quote about Tanuro Shalachnai?
Yeah, right.
Maybe I want to add another point, if that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think Va'ani Eyeh is really Eyeh Asher Eyeh. That's the God that she's talking to.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So to me, actually, one of my favorite things in this midrash is this word Mamtin Lach. Right, I've been waiting for you. There's actually another midrash that I can't remember if Tamar wrote the other one also that I put together sometimes to teach with this one, which also has the image of God's waiting. It's like, this is an image that sticks with her. It comes up in two midrashim, I think, of the idea that like, oh, we think of ourselves as like, you know, we're waiting for God. Like, you know, why didn't God pull her in to have a conversation with her earlier? And God says like, no, I've been waiting for you. And I wanted you to ask this question. I just want everyone to notice that the question to ask me is the word here for ask is kashia, right? Akashia is a, both, she's studying Torah with God now, right? She's bringing akashia on the text. And God's like, I'm so glad you brought this kashia. And also like, akashia is not a bad thing in rabbinic Judaism. That's how we move forward. That's how we make our religion. That's how rabbinic texts unfold, is that somebody brings akashia and that's what moves the conversation forward. And here God is saying to her, like, this conversation was stuck because nobody was bringing the akashia. And I'm so glad you finally brought the akashia and now we can move this conversation forward. It's like what she is doing is good. And also she's behaving like a Talmud scholar in that she's bringing this out. So I love your read on Anehiyah and also the Miva'er as like reveal. It's not so much a word that we use in Hebrew, but in English, like revelation. God is literally like, I actually have some more revelation I've been holding on to. And now I get a chance to share it with you. And then there's something striking to me about the fact that God doesn't just dive in with an answer, but God doesn't say, I'm so glad you asked the question now, blah, 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 blah. But God then says like, so ask the question. And then she actually gets to ask the question, right? We're not going to beat around the bush. I'm not going to say, this text seems to imply a question of were the women at Sinai. She gets to explicitly ask this question, right? This woman in this story gets to say, were the women at Sinai? And she gets to say it directly to God. I think there is something really powerful about the fact that the story is based not in a Beit Midrash, but in the sort of like ritual chanting in shul, right? Because there's a way in which when you hear Torah in shul, like all of, like, some of us hear it refracted through all the Midrashim and all of the history, and some of it is like, actually, sometimes all of that strips away. I feel like that's actually why I have this experience like every year, at least once, but many times, where you're like, was that verse in the Torah here? I don't remember it being phrased that way. Or like, you know, it's like, obviously, yes, it was. But somehow you hear it differently. And that's like, that's this experience that she's having, that somehow she's hearing it in shul means she's hearing it without the commentary. Yeah.
But Lyle, to your point, I don't think that she's saying that women weren't there. I think she's saying God may not have been speaking to the women who were there.
Yeah.
And that's where her question, to follow up on that, I'm playing with the preposition, ula isha, a little deeper. Is it la isha? I mean, after the translation, I caught my two women with women. Does it matter that much? But I bumped on that as I was reading between the Hebrew and the English. It may not matter at all. Maybe it just be semantics. Because I think the point is that she feels like the intended audience of God's speech was the specific people who were listed.
Yeah.
Which included Ata and all of these people in relation to the Ata and not adult women.
Okay, I'm going to move us forward, and then I'm sure hopefully the comments will be relevant still.
The Holy Blessed One lifted up her head and said, "When Moses ascended, I commanded him, and have them make themselves ready for the third day. For on the third day, God will come down before all the people on Mount Sinai. Since Moses distanced himself from women, for he separated from his wife Zipporah, he brought only men near the mountain, as is said, and Moses brought the people toward God from the camp. And at that time, when Moses heard the commandments and there were only men around him, he heard, 'You shall do no work,' and said to himself, 'And who will be punished for doing work if not the man? And whose are the slaves and slave girls, chattel and children, whom he can command to do work or to rest, if not the man?'"
Okay, so somebody first give us the, like, what is the explanation? And then you can tell us whether you buy this or how you understand it. Yeah.
The answer to her question is they weren't there.
And why not?
They were deliberately excluded.
Because Moses right. misunderstood.
I mean, they were excluded.
Right.
Whether it was a mishearing, it was a mishearing. Right. Whether that was intentional or not is to be speculated.
Yeah.
I disagree slightly, John. I think what she's saying is actually the women were included in the commandment.
In the commandment.
But the women were included in the commandment. Moses misheard the commandment.
Right.
His
whole
false sense of piety.
Right.
Led him down a path where his distance from his wife and other women
led him
to turn lota se into a masculine only commandment. And so and I think what she's doing here is a brilliant close reading. That was my editorial.
Yeah. It's Moses's fault.
Right.
Yeah. That would be my really distilled down version of this, right? It's Moses' fault that this happened. It's interesting. I'm curious if you read it as like, this is an excuse, or is this an indictment of Moses? Or is this like, you know, it was a reasonable mistake. Like, he didn't have any women around. He thought that he heard it. I said it to him. This is what happens. You know, makes me think of like, there's this sort of like modern kitschy phrase of like, nothing about us without us. The concept is not kitschy, just the phrase maybe. of saying like, oh, if you try to talk about people and they're not in the room, like it's hard actually to hold the experience of other people who aren't in the room when they're not in the room. It's easy to forget about their experience when they're not in the room. And maybe this is like, yeah, it would have been very hard actually for Moses to like, think about, like, to hold, you know, he's getting revelation and he's trying to translate it to the people and it's like the women weren't there, so he just didn't think about it. Is this a reasonable excuse or is this like just a, you know, tremendous indictment of Moses of like he made a colossal mistake of sending the women away and therefore the women weren't there? Yeah, there's one more. We'll do one more paragraph. I think it's actually the same idea. And so
Moshe wrote the men to keep the Sabbath in the masculine pronoun. And because he was not me'urav im habriot, engaged with people, briot in the feminine, for he had not been with his wife Zipporah for a long time, He did not remember that women, too, have desire, and so he did not include them in the prohibition not to covet.
Yeah, okay, sorry, we should have read this one before. This is, like, the second problem, right? Oh, like, he forgot that women also have feelings and might covet because he wasn't around, Tzipor. It's the same problem, it's just the explanation of the other mitzvah, yeah.
There are classic midrashim that note Moses' inability and incapability, right? He can't get the idea of the Mishkan in his head, and he needs to turn to Bezalel because mm-hmm. he just can't do it.
Yeah.
Or he's in the back of Rabbi Akiva's classroom, and right. He doesn't get anything that's being said.
Yeah.
It seems like it's not the criticism here is only a matter of degree.
Yeah.
Right. It's not that Moses didn't have his faults. The rabbis, of course, he.
Or maybe not even degree. Maybe it's. Maybe it's like, that's what happened. He was human. Meaning, I don't know, we might not like that answer.
But I was going to say, there's an amplifying of the repercussions, mm-hmm. right? You know, there's no Bezalel
right.
to turn to say,
right.
no, I got it, don't worry about it.
Right. It makes me think, like, what if now we were like, we've been making the menorah wrong this whole time. And God will be like, finally, you asked the kashya. Yeah. you want to read our...
Sure. The young woman asked the Holy Blessed One, if so, and Moses, who separated from women, could not hear those words which the Holy Blessed One ordained for them, will a sage who has not separated himself be able to hear?
Okay, so she... A couple things. First of all, she gets to ask her questions to God. That's awesome. She gets to be like, okay, I hear what you're saying. And this is where I feel like this midrash sort of like jumps out of the Torah, right? We were in the story of Moses, and she's like, okay, I gotcha, I understand. What about now? And her question about now, right, is if Moses, who's the awesomest, wasn't able to make this jump, what about scholars today? Would a scholar today, a male scholar today, be able to hold in their mind women's experience? And God answers.
The Holy Blessed One's countenance became grave, and he answered her thus, any Beit Midrash that has no women, my word will not emerge from there whole. Yeah.
This is the mic drop, right? What is the takeaway of this midrash? What is this midrash trying to tell you?
It's a combination of when there's theodicy and there's good and evil in the world, we can attribute a lot of it to human behavior, not just to this existential mm-hmm. God, and therefore we can correct it.
Yeah, those are... beautiful takeaways. I feel like she has a really specific way to correct it that she's suggesting.
Yeah, put women in the conversation.
Put women in the Beit Midrash.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, she seems to be suggesting that revelation as it was given wasn't whole.
That's true.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Revelation.
What we got wasn't complete.
Right. Revelation hasn't been whole.
Yeah.
Revelation could be whole. Those alone are profound, and then she has this very clear answer at the end of like, and how do we make it whole? We put women in the Beit Midrash. That is the only way to make it whole. It won't be whole. And there is something striking here about God's mood changing, right? Mm. It's not, this doesn't end, and God... laughed a big laugh and said, now you understand, right? God is not, is like...
pessimistic.
Oh, pessimistic is interesting. I don't know if I would say pessimistic, but like unhappy, right? God knows there's a lot of unwhole Beit Midrash, you know.
Right.
Torah is still not whole. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if it also shows that maybe some self-reflection on God's part, like... should God have been upset during the original revelation that God didn't go and correct Moshe?
Yeah.
You know, maybe God is like having some personal development here.
Right. I always want to like yell back to this midrash. Like, why doesn't she say like, and why didn't you talk to Miriam? Huh?
Right.
You had another prophet. You chose this. Yeah.
You know, you have with Adam telling Chava And he repeats, you know, the commandment to her, don't eat it, but then he adds, don't touch it. And the rabbis create a whole big drash about, like, how that is actually the cause of the sin, right? It's because he added to it.
And this also, right, I feel like if the two takeaways are women belong in the Beit Midrash and also, like, God's waiting for us, right, is, like, the depressing part is we have been living with a not full Torah, but the empowering part is that it's actually now in our hands to make it whole. We don't have to wait for God to, like, do more revelation. We get to make it whole. Okay, last comment, and then we're going to move to the next one.
So I think it's interesting that we started with the Beit Knesset and we go to the Beit Midrash.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of what it's saying is that we're not, like, it doesn't say, like, any, I just, like, wonder, it's like the point that you're not changing the text, but you're maybe, like, what does it mean for the text to be Shalem?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I just think it's curious, because it's not like rewrite the Torah and read it in the Beit Knesset, like, in this way.
Yes.
It sort of ends with anything, like, the women, you know, the women have to be in the place where the studying happens. I think that's an interesting
kind of
parallel, like the two places that you could have ended the story. You could have ended the story back in Beit Knesset.
Right.
Which would have had its own meaning, but
that's super interesting. I never thought about that distinction. I feel like it does help me think about, right, there's different approaches that different Jews take to solving these problems. And this is the, you know, her solution is to write Midrash. She plans to solve these problems in the Beit Midrash.
Yeah.
All right, we're gonna read the next one. This Midrash is written by a different author, a woman named Orna Peltz. I can't give you her whole biography because I don't know it, sorry, but I'll find it out.
The king of Egypt said to the midwives, when you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live.
All right. Normally, I would, like, stop here and say, like, where are we in the story? But we know, like, this group. Yeah, we know where we are. Okay, coming up for Pesach.
The midwives feared God in awe and did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live.
Okay. We are going to connect Ur-Iten and Vatir-Enna. They saw, they, like, look at the birth stool, and the midwives feared. They had Yir-Ah. Okay, I don't think I want to say anything else before we start. Okay, so you can just start us.
The midwives were asked, where did you get your fearful awe of God?
I'm going to pause this already. When sometimes I teach this, it's like a question of, like, well, what makes the Midrash feminist? What makes it feminist Midrash? What makes feminist Torah? I just feel like this Midrash opening with Nishalu HaMeyaldot, right, is like, well, ask women. Like, what is this Midrash trying to teach us? Like, ask questions directly to women, and then you will find answers. Just don't want us to, like, skip over some of those really radical things, like the last one where a woman gets to ask her question to God. In this one, you know, and it's like, who's asking? I don't know. Just ask. You know, like, we asked. Somebody asked. Maybe in the Beit Midrash, right? This is another feeling. You feel like the midwives are in the Beit Midrash. And the question is, where did you get your fearful awe? This is like minayin, right? This is like a halachic question. Like, from where did you learn? Like, what is the basis? Their answer won't be Sinai because
they weren't there.
Sinai hasn't happened yet. Right. They definitely weren't at Sinai. We found some women who definitely weren't at Sinai, not because the women weren't at Sinai, but because A, they may or may not be Jewish, and B, Sinai is in the future for them. So they have Yirat Hashem. Where did it come from? Okay.
And they answered, from the great and deep things that we saw at the birth stool, from the mystery that embraces us morning and evening, human being after human being coming into the world, where does he come from and what does he bring with him? The goodness that her mother sees in her.
See, this is where the Hebrew says, the goodness that his mother sees in him. I don't, they changed it, but yeah.
Oh, okay. The compassion and the love that he awakens, crying babies bursting forth from exhausted bodies, and the soft seal of God's finger imprinted on their faces.
All right. Their answer is from watching the miracle of childbirth, right? This is a very common answer, right? When did you experience God? When did you see God? When did you know God? How do you know God? From watching babies being born, you know? A fun thing about teaching this Midrash is that often when I say, like, Who in this room has seen a baby being born? Raise your hand. Yeah, most of the room. It's like a funny, it's an interesting thing that like oftentimes like more of the men have seen a baby being born. Even when the women have birthed babies, they haven't had this midwife experience of like seeing a baby being born, which is like kind of an interesting thing. These women, they know God from watching babies being born, and some of that is instantly relatable, right? So first of all, the he's, I feel like, should stay as he's, right? Because we are talking about why did they not kill the baby boys? Like, I think this is about the boys. And when you swap it in, it actually, like, weakens what the story, confuses what the story is. It's a good example of, like, in classical Midrash, you might say, like, oh, it always meant to be men and women. But in modern Midrash, like, they wrote it for a reason. Let's read the Midrash they wrote. I think also, right, that the goodness that his mother sees in him, the compassion and the love that awakens, right? It's not just that babies exist, which is pretty amazing and awe-inspiring. It's actually from watching the way the mothers respond to the babies, right? It's from watching the way that childbirth, opens up a compassion and a love. And I also think that when we say, like, crying babies bursting forth from exhausted bodies, it's like, obviously, that could be exhaustion from labor, from childbirth itself. But these women are slaves, right? It's not just that they're tired because they had babies. It's like, from the experience of watching women who are slaves birth children and then manage to find in them compassion and love, that experience, the fact that slave women can find their humanity and love their babies is actually what I think also inspires their answer. And then we end with, this is a reference to this Masechet, Sugya and Masechet Nida, that says God, you know all of Torah before you're born, and then God's angel, like, you know, touches your lips to... You know, and that's when you forget your Torah. So that's here, God's finger imprinted on their faces, is a reference to that sugya.
The midwives were challenged, but didn't it happen at Sinai that all the people saw the thunder and the lightning, the voice of the shofar, and the smoking mountain? The people saw it and trembled and stood far off. And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, to keep the fearful awe of God before you, so that you will not transgress. The fearful awe of God comes from the place of thunder and lightning."
Okay, so people, the midwives were challenged, right? And they get a kashia now, another kashia. And what's the challenge?
That you can only get the fear and trouble from Mount Sinai. Now, when Am Yisrael was able to have that awe.
Right. Revelation doesn't come from babies. Revelation comes from knowledge of God doesn't come from babies, watching babies being born. It comes from Sinai. It should come from Sinai. Okay, so it gives us the opportunity to do this comparison, right? Baby birthing and Sinai. What are the comparisons here? What are they saying about Sinai that is opposite or different from birthing of babies?
And the midwives answer. There is a fearful awe that comes from external seeing, and there is a fearful awe that comes from internal vision. A person can be frozen in terror witnessing a supernatural miracle, which awakens and strengthens her sense of fearful awe. But for us, it doesn't work like that. Our fearful awe is not in the heavens. Our fearful awe is of God, arises precisely from within nature, from within the pain of what we witness on the birthstool. From there, we learn to choose what is good, to protect life, to fight against death, and to resist evil.
Okay. They're saying there's two kinds of relationships you can have with God, right? One is Yirah. That's the big mountain. Some Yirah comes from external seeing, Ri'yah, and some comes from internal vision. And this is how they're going to put them against each other, right? You can have revelation from Sinai, which is loud, and it's big, and it's external, and it's supernatural, and it's everybody all at once, all these sort of things that go with Sinai. And then there's a different kind of revelation of understanding, which is from birth, which is inside, and it's private, and it's very intimate, and it doesn't happen to everybody all at once. Like, not everybody has babies or sees babies being born all at once, right? It's like, you know, I had my revelations experience at this age, and you had yours at that age, and, you know, like, whenever you saw a baby being born, and maybe if you're a midwife, it's like daily in your life. There are these very different, and it's the natural, right? The supernatural and the natural, what could be, you know, in some ways you're like, oh my God, you just made a baby. That doesn't seem natural. And yet it's natural. and these women are being able to put these two up against each other. And I'll just highlight, and then I want to hear your reflections. To me, the line that is so striking that I just want to hold on to from this midrash is that etzleinu in hadavarkach. For us, it doesn't work that way. Just as this like slight easy line to open up to say like, what works for you might not work for me. And like revelation, like maybe we aren't, you know, we aren't all going to experience revelation in the same way. That's how you experience revelation. That's not how we experience revelation. We know God. How do you know God? You weren't even at Sinai. It's like, okay, we know God differently. Like I have a different way in. I have a different path in, which I think is, in some ways we can read it as like, you know, I'm the one, just to be clear, that's putting this under this heading of like, we're the women at Sinai and, you know, two different approaches to thinking about feminist Torah and how we're thinking about this. But that this, so maybe this is like, you know what, women don't have to find Torah the way that men find Torah. Maybe there's other ways. Maybe there's going to be different stories and different narratives. But also it could be much more personal, right? Which is to say like, not everyone has to find revelation and experience revelation in the same way. For some people, Sinai is where it's at, and for some people, you will find God and experience God through, you know, the birth stool, and that will offer something different. Okay, a bunch of hands. Betsy.
I wonder if the author is aware of Hamid Javar's comments on I think it's in his introduction to the Midbar. When he talks about the Am Yisrael going from a mindset of Teva Shel Nes to a mindset of Nes Shel Teva, which he gets from Rav Kook. And in that idea, people have first been moved by spectacle and sensory phenomena.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a stage one. But a more sophisticated stage is that more integrated one of finding the Nes in Teva.
Yeah.
So it would be lovely to say that she's, you know, aware of that and bringing that, because it's actually a higher, it's the next level, it's a more mature level.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I first learned that idea sort of from Rabbi Art Green, who would say like the supernatural contained within the natural. You know, he's very like pantheist. There is something interesting here where I don't hear them saying in this midrash, like, and we have a stronger connection to God or a better connection or we're a more advanced connection, right? It's just like, it's like, it works differently for us. You know, like, okay, you'll have that, we'll have this, like, they're all good. It does feel to me strikingly different than the first midrash, where the bottom line is like, get your butts in the baby midrash and start writing more Torah. It's like, if that's what works for you, great. You know, you can go there.
Yeah, the first midrash is like, bringing women into the Beit Midrash is going to change it for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Versus this Midrash is saying something that I say all the time, like, there are lots of paths to God. Choose one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what? Just there are lots of ways to experience God. There's not just this one way in the Torah, but a whole bunch of other different ways.
Right.
Here's
right.
Our way, and what this Midrash also opens up is like, what's your way?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So I think I'm probably one of the people who prefers the first version to the second, which you warned about at the beginning.
Well, you're all in a yeshiva, so it's a little bit of a... it's a little stacked deck.
I do hear the, sort of the echoes of, like, Hagar in Bereshit 16:13, right, where she talks about, you know, Eloi, right?
Mm-hmm.
God, excuse me. And I actually think this would have been stronger if it had been less essentialist and actually been more deliberate in its calling on that. And talk about it in more of a sense of, yes, there are different paths, my personal path as opposed to sort of like, this is really much more, oh, ours is sort of from nature, you know, but actually ro'i isn't necessarily from nature. Like there's different kinds of ra'aya,
yeah,
you know, and maybe that is in opposition to lightning and thunder, but that's, there are, even within that, there are different kinds of things, and we don't have to necessarily essentialize it and link it to particular gender orientations.
Right. I also think it's interesting that nature, like, what can mean a lot of things, right? It's like, oh, go, you know, there's like trees and waterfalls. And certainly if I was like, where do you see God? Many of those answers come up. But I just love that the description is like of the mothers and the way the mothers interact with the babies is like, actually it's like in humanity. It's, you know, it feels like a different midrash almost to say like, they see it in babies being born versus like, they see it in like people who are downtrodden being able to find and get in touch with their own humanity and like choose to have the next generation. That's where they see God. It just feels different and less gendered. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, that's for everybody to be moved and inspired by and participate in. Yeah.
So I'm hearing a little bit of like, oh, there's number one, number two. I actually think that they come together perfectly.
Yeah.
When we were finishing the conversation, the first one, we were talking, what I got hooked on also was when the woman says, well, a sage who is not separate himself be able to hear, there's two things. She's talking about a single man.
Mm-hmm.
And then the response from the Holy One is that women need to have a voice. And I was as compelled by the idea that there need to be many voices discussing Torah as opposed to a single sage who's there to be the revelator to bring down the single revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I turn that into what the second one says, it's like you need multiple voices,
yeah,
and they
right.
need to have multiple
right.
perspectives
right.
and multiple experiences
right.
to really understand the depth and breadth and brilliance of Torah. You need multiple voices that
yeah.
include all the different human experiences.
Yeah.
And only then, when you create that learning experience, that kind of yeshiva, will you begin to understand Torah.
It's also great, it's a great, like just to add, build on that point, is that all of the statements in the second midrash are plural. Right? The first one is just God and this one woman, and this one is like Nishalu and, you know, Hikshu. Like, they're both directions are multiple people, multiple
yeah.
perspectives. Let's do John and then you.
So I thought I was surprised and like, I don't know, excited with the sort of the way that the second one ended, because I thought it was more radical than what I was expecting,
uh-huh.
which is that, you know, with the words that were highlighted, when you go to the classic approach, it's like,
yeah.
let's find the verbs that have re'e in them.
Yeah.
There's a connection between sight
yeah.
and fear. We're going to find that. And I went back to their first answer and I was like, well, there's re'e verbs that nobody
yeah.
highlighted here.
Yeah.
So I thought they were going to, you know, we'd go back and say, like, no, see, our seeing led to our fear.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of thing. But then the answer was, there are different sources of revelation and
yeah.
different sources of authority.
Yeah.
And I don't have to play your root, your shoreish game
yeah.
to
Love
have,
it.
You
right.
know, knowledge
right.
of God.
So it's like,
it
it's,
comes from somewhere
it's subverting
else.
Of the... It's both using a traditional mode, but then also
but
simultaneously
then
subverting
not,
the mode.
Yeah, it's not a monopoly on how you
yeah.
get to
yeah.
your fear.
Yeah, that's really nice. That's really nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it the intention of the author, and I know this is a dangerous question, or a meaningless question,
yeah.
Depending on how dairy god we want to be, is that in the intention of the author that Shifra, that the midwives are Shifra and Pua Stam, or the Midrashic, Shifra and Pua really
of
Miriam and
Yehudit. Yeah.
Well, because then you have Miriam becomes another source of revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It becomes much more of a parallel source of revelation to Sinai.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. My gut is that this is reading it not as the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just, like, the question of where do you know God from feels like it would be a weird question to ask a prophet. Like, meaning, like, you know, asking Miriam, it would be like, well, because Miriam actually... it strikes
yeah.
me that the Midrash, like, my instinct is more that it's like Dafka non-Jews. It's like, how do these non-Jewish women pre-Sinai have a fear of God?
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? Because this question is a question, again, that is not new, right? The start,
right.
the Midrash is new, and the answer is new, and the version of this answer. But the question of, like, why would these women defy Pharaoh? Like, that is not a thing. We don't even, like, defy you know, parking signs, like to defy Pharaoh in ancient Egypt. It's like, that's not a thing. There's something really striking here about what these
Well, but that makes it even, there's an even different emphasis on it, because now they're they're non-Israelite, non-Jewish women. How do you, right. non-Israelite woman,
right.
get revelation?
Right.
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 Then Sinai becomes a very
right.
different kind of. It's not.
Right.
It's not. It's also not meant for you.
Right. And also, what are they doing in the Beit Midrash?
Yeah.
Like, how do they get here? Why
yeah.
are you asking them questions? Dershuni as a whole, as a genre, has amazing ability. Like, an amazing technique that runs through is like asking questions of people and characters that you would not otherwise expect. So one of the first Midrashim that I used to love to teach is a Midrash on Noah. The flood story, and it is like a read on post Holocaust sociology, I would even say less theology and more sociology, like how do different people respond after the Holocaust? So it takes up like what are different responses after the flood, and it's through the eyes of the birds. The question is like it opens with the birds of the Beit Midrash asked, whatever happened to the dove and the raven? Like, where are they? It's like, okay, we picked up with Noah, but like the dove and the raven, the birds, because we don't notice what happened to the dove and the raven, who cares? We're people. We don't notice birds. But the birds, Beit Midrash, they notice, and like they ask the question. And so the whole Midrash is set in the voice of the birds of the Beit Midrash, and then it's like this brilliant reading of the different, what things the birds did into different approaches. Like they find the dove and the raven, and they've lived very different lives, and it's like a metaphor of how post-Shoah different responses. It's a really interesting. Okay, I'll just share. I put on, tacked on the end here, two poems that are not from Dershuni. But this isn't a perfect mapping, but I think of, the first is from Merle Feld. It's called We All Stood Together. And I think if you were to sort of say there's two different ways, again, an oversimplification, two different ways of approaching feminist Torah. One is to say the women were at Sinai, and the other is to say, like, actually, women can find revelation from other places, and they don't need, the Beit Midrash is not the only answer, and or all people could. These poems maybe give us a window into that. Someone read for us.
We all stood together. My brother and I were at Sinai. He kept a journal of what he saw, of what he heard, of what it all meant to him. I wish I had such a record of what happened to me there. It seems like every time I wanted to write, I want to write, I can't. I'm always holding a baby, one of my own or one for a friend, always holding a baby. So my hands are never free to write things down. And then as time passes, the particulars, the hard data, the who, what, when, where, why slip away from me. And all I'm left with is the feeling. But feelings are just sounds, the vowel barking of a mute. My brother is so sure of what he heard. After all, he got a record of it. Consonant after consonant after consonant. If we remembered it together, we could recreate holy time, sparks flying.
I just think it's a powerful. So I offer this one to read in parallel with the first Midrash. Mm-hmm. And then the second one. The second one is also a response to more Sinai-based, but I think an interesting read with the second one. Does someone want to read? This is a Hebrew poem, but we could read it in the translation.
Everyone had already gone up to the mountain and was waiting to see, waiting with great stillness that is so out of character. Even the donkeys and the camels are immersed in the quiet. No bird chirps, even the children on their father's shoulders. And the tremendous quiet is too much to bear, like before a great and horrible event. Yet I still wanted to hang up the laundry and leave time to dab on perfume. And I warmed the baby's milk so he wouldn't be hungry and start to cry, heaven forbid, at the wrong moment. How much time until it's over? I expect the laundry will dry out, but the baby, who knows? No one knew. And I saw that a light wind, like the breath of a sleeping man, went through the laundry and inflated the belly of my nightgown and the Sabbath tablecloth was a white sail in the middle of the desert, and we departed from there upon the pale blue to a faraway place where we'll crack open pomegranates and suck their juices, to a place where love is the Shem HaMifolash.
A different version of where we might, how we might experience revelation. All right. Thank you.